Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series where we look at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished up watching Spike Lee's classic 1989 film, Do the Right Thing.
That we did.
We did indeed. I'd seen this film a couple of times before, but you had not. I guess, what's your initial takeaway, or your initial impression of the movie?
I thought it was a very well-made film.
Yeah.
An enjoyable film. And a meaty film to think about.
Yeah, especially, I suppose, given time and place of when it was made. It's probably more relevant now as it was when it was made, I guess.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah,
it really is.
I'll give a quick plot synopsis before we kind of jump into the actual discussion of the film. The film takes place in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood in Brooklyn, in New York, and follows a pizza delivery boy, Mookie, on his life during one day, during the middle of this giant heat wave that's hitting New York. And we're kind of introduced through him to the little microcosm that is this small neighborhood, and what kind of goes on to the individuals that live there throughout the day. Kind of racial tension slowly building into a riot, I guess, due to a incident that happens involving one of the characters, Radio Raheem, and some police.
Yeah. So the film... Let's... Before we start with the movie...
Yep.
Let's talk about Spike Lee a bit, because he's kind of... He's kind of a political figure, almost. Things that, you know, the kind of films that he makes and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think I was... doing a little bit of research and things for this one, came across an interesting opinion, which I kind of think is an apt one, where Spike Lee unfortunately gets labelled as a angry kind of political militant man because that's the art he makes.
Mm.
And so he's therefore, everyone assumes, he's this very aggressive, outspoken kind of...
Yeah, but are they attributing that?
Little guy.
Are they attributing that not because of the interviews, perhaps they've seen of him? But
he comes across very blunt in interviews, and
he's kind of serious.
Yeah, if you ask a stupid question, he's gonna treat you like you've asked a fucking stupid question. But I think
rightly so, I suppose.
I think the general idea that people have about Spike Lee is more informed by the type of films he makes as opposed to the actual individual he is. But being said, the art that you create is a reflection of yourself, I suppose.
Yeah, so. But should you, like, what do you reckon about the degree at which you should separate the artist from their art?
Well, I think in the case of Do the Right Thing, it makes it really difficult because Spike Lee is credited as writer, director, producer, and star of the film.
Yeah.
So it's...
If there's anyone that's...
It's very clearly his voice, I guess, which makes it kind of a little bit hard to... disassociate him with it, but
he's clearly very passionate about
very much so. I mean, well, he's got a new film out at the moment called Chirac, which is all about pretty much the same thing again. Like, it's just one of those history repeating itself, and this time dealing with all the shit that's gone down in Chicago this year. So
but then, I mean, I haven't seen many of his films.
Yeah,
I've seen 25th Hour,
yep,
which I thought was great.
Yeah,
and again, that's kind of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Racial tension and stuff like
that. Yeah, in particular. And it's got very similar moments to Do the Right Thing. Towards the end of that film, you've got that scene where Edward Norton's in the bathroom and he's talking to himself in the mirror. And you actually, I think the other characters as well end up looking straight down into the lens, breaking the fourth wall and kind of ranting about all the kind of issues and shit that they're dealing with at the time. So
it's kind of similar to... Who did Philadelphia?
Jonathan Demme.
That's right, Demi, that's right.
And then...
Silence
of the Lambs as well, like the direct looking at the audience shots. Yeah.
And it works really well to kind of just have... You cannot not pay attention at that point.
Yeah, this person is addressing you directly. Yeah. So other than 25th Hour, had you seen, or at least kind of had kind of passing knowledge of any of the other films he's made?
Not really. I'm aware that he does music videos and that he did, I think, a music video for Beastie Boys. I think we'll probably see that.
No.
He didn't do one?
Not that I know of, no. He may have, but it's not one on the collection.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different thing that he did. Mm. Oh, no. Didn't he do that strange Bjork?
No, that's Spike Jones.
Oh, Spike Jones.
Different Spike, yeah.
But, the white one.
Yeah. I mean, he's an interesting filmmaker in that he's very well known, especially for this film, because, I mean, it made such a huge cultural impact, and it's a very important film. But he's one of those filmmakers that has been around for so long and is very highly regarded. He's like Woody Allen to me. Like, this guy's made a lot of films, four of which that are good.
Yeah. Yeah, he's fucking prolific. Like, he's doing two or three films a year.
But again, like most recent, like Red Hook Summer and stuff, like some of his more recent films, nobody fucking saw. And they were like VOD films.
That's what I mean. Like, I know of the name because he's done some incredible films.
Yeah.
But then I had no idea his filmography is like fucking, I don't know, 50 titles long.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they always just seem to just float away.
He has the thing of, like, he makes a lot of very personal films. Like, Crooklyn is a film that's very much informed by his family life and the way he grew up and things. And it's a family story, but it's, like, yeah, it's not that great. Like, I'm not the biggest fan. Like, I think he's at his best, obviously. This is him at the peak of his abilities, and I don't think he ever got close to anything as good as Do the Right Thing again. And it's just kind of a bit of a shame that it was his...
That's second, like, that's 89 third, though. That's 1989.
Yeah, so.
Well, it must have just been a lightning in a bottle, almost.
I mean, he followed this one up with Malcolm X, which is, as far as biopics go, is a really fucking solid biopic, and Denzel Washington's amazing in it. But other than that, he just kind of made film. Like, they're not bad, but they're not great. It's. To use something that's kind of apt for where we are at the moment, like Red Letter Media's review of Star Wars A New Force Awakens, they said the problem with Star Wars films is they're trying to follow one of the greatest films ever made, and like one of the greatest sequels ever made, Empire Strikes Back, and so there's the high watermark that no matter what, you can't hit that again, and I think that's kind of what has happened with
Spike. If you're trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, which Spike Lee kind of is with his films.
Yeah.
Like... And I just think it's that thing. He keeps trying and he makes competent films, but he is just hit the high watermark that is Do the Right Thing.
It seems like his message is always very much the same thing.
Yeah.
That is, think twice about violence.
Yeah,
think
and also, like, race is an issue. Which is like, yeah, well, of course.
Of course it is.
Of course it is.
It's good because some people forget that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why you need these kinds of films.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the film.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, like, right off the bat, I thought it was kind of serendipitous, like, the time and place where we watched it was, it was funny that we watched it over last weekend, where Melbourne, where we live, obviously, went through the hottest fucking December night on record, and it was, we ourselves were in the middle of a heat wave, kind of sitting, watching this film.
Yes.
Made me kind of empathize a little bit with the characters.
Although I didn't end up, like, you know, having racial hate in my blood, but...
The not being able to escape the heat didn't piss you off at all.
I've got aircon.
Yeah, well, that's true.
If those guys had aircon,
it would all
maybe
be
if,
fine.
Maybe if Sal's pizzeria had aircon, it would be fucking different story.
He'd be like, yeah, it's fine, bugging out. Put a picture of Malcolm X up on the wall. Yeah. I don't mind.
Maybe Radio Raheem would be alive.
But I think, like, the thing that stands out to me, obviously, with this film, apart from Spike Lee's fucking amazing script, is... Ernest Dickinson's cinematography on it is fucking amazing.
It's pretty exceptional.
The kind of use... I was reading up, apparently, because it was actually filmed on this one-block neighbourhood in Bed-Stuy, like, actually where it's set, and they went in and they painted a lot of the buildings, and red and orange and things to kind of accentuate the idea of heat. And you can fucking feel the warmth and the heat coming off of the fucking TV watching this movie.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because I thought a thought that perhaps it was actually... They'd tinted the film itself.
No,
like
that was
all filtered out to make it feel just such, like, warm colours everywhere.
No, it was the production design. What they did was they painted a lot of the buildings, and then also with costume and things, that the way that they dressed people was kind of to help accentuate the idea of kind of darker, richer colours to kind of give you this idea of a sweltering heat. And it... fucking works incredibly.
You do seem to feel it.
For a film, like, I kind of noticed, like, there was only one point, like, usually when you're watching a movie where it's, like, somewhere hot, like, Lawrence of Arabia, like, the desert scene, you have that kind of sweltering kind of steam lines you get in front of the camera when you're looking at something far away, and it kind of...
Yeah, they have that illusion.
Yeah, yeah. There's only one shot in this entire film that has that to kind of give you the idea that there's heat here. The rest of it is just maintained through performance and acting, and also the color palette they use, which is very effective.
Yeah, I mean, just all the behaviors. I mean, I think one of my favorite situations is just coming back to those three elderly men that are just constantly doing fuck all with their day.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Complaining about the heat and everything else.
And it's absolutely brilliant. It's that thing of you can't tell if it's scripted that way or if it is just those three actors, like Frankie Faison, I forget who the other two are. Robin Harris is one of the others, and they just kind of sit there and they're. You can't tell if it's just them fucking around and riffing, or if it is
riffing, right?
Yeah, I mean the it's just so fucking naturalistic. It's nuts.
Yeah,
like
everybody's performance is like that.
Mm.
There's not it's an interesting film because it's almost like it's perfect.
Yeah.
In pretty much every way.
Yeah.
There's no bad performance. Not a single word could have been done. You know, worse.
Yeah.
Or better.
Yeah.
I know. It just didn't need to be different.
Even, like, I suppose I would say the weakest performance element would maybe be Rosie Perez.
But that's probably because of her voice, though.
But I don't think it's necessarily because of her voice, but by saying weakest, I think it's maybe because of her inexperience. This was her first film. But by saying she was the weakest, that's not a put-down. Like, she's not weak in the film at all, I think. It's just, I don't know, there's something about her that the character is maybe a little bit one-dimensional that makes it less of a...
She's Mookie's...
the mother of his girlfriend, the mother of his child. Yeah.
She just irritates me, man, the voice.
It's the voice thing.
It's like that chick, the Fester Adams chick in Sid and Nancy.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
She was also, like, her performance was just horrible, but but the voice didn't help.
Yeah, yeah. So every time she pops up and talks, you're like,
Find some aircon and fuck off.
Yeah, pretty much. Just go have some ice rubbed on your nipples and be quiet.
They'll find nipples, though.
Wow.
Cheers.
But, jumping back to the cinematography, it was... I know you pointed out when we were watching it that there were a lot of Dutch angles, and
But only... I mean, I kind of... Sometimes Dutch angles just become too much, like they're overused, and they're used when not necessary, but... The Dutch angles here were, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
But it's always during moments of conflict between two or more characters.
Yeah, and it kind of works well to kind of, I guess, visually explain to the audience, like, the view of either both these characters or at least one of these characters is...
At odds,
yeah. Or kind of skewed. That way we're going to kind of skew the actual framing of the film itself to kind of accentuate that. I keep using that word today, I don't know
why. That's okay. But it's that... The Dutch angle it feels cheap sometimes because it's obviously, it's so obvious what it is. There's not much creative merit in it,
but it's way
more interesting than just doing a flat, you know, they're having a dialogue.
Yeah,
now.
And I think because the dialogue is so rich in this film that they earn it. They earn the right to be able to actually use it. Whereas a lot of films just are like...
Just use it cause.
Yeah, just cause. Whereas in this one, you're like, no, okay, yeah, you're talking some serious shit here, and I'll allow it.
But it was the Dutch angles, not only just the Dutch angles, but as the dialogue progressed into more hate-fueled, like racism or just bashing heads, the Dutch angles started to just draw into faces more and more and more. So it was stuff like that which
yeah, it's kind of interesting to see with, like, in particular those scenes where there is conflict between two characters. If it's not necessarily on a Dutch angle, like you're saying, it draws you in. We slowly get closer and closer and closer in the framing to the actual character's face, and then there are some times where we just then have the relief and we pull back out.
And sometimes it goes as far as, like, the character switches from talking to the character to straight to camera.
Yeah, like, the great example of that is, I suppose, Radio Raheem giving his monologue about the love-hate.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Where we kind of shift in, the camera steps into the place of where Mookie Spike Lee was actually standing and where his POV, and as he finishes, the camera swings back out the other side.
Yeah,
and
to just remind you that he
steps back into the frame. It's fucking brilliant.
That's probably, like, that's a highlight right there.
I also, the one scene to me that is an absolute fucking standout is the scene where Bugging Out awesomely played by Giancarlo Esposito, or Gus from Breaking Bad, like way early in his career. He when he cracks it at Sal's for not having any black people up on the Wall of Fame, and his that kind of the thing that starts the it propels the narrative forward, I guess, as the film goes along. But there's a scene where he's losing it at Sal. Sal's losing it at him, and to kind of diffuse the situation, Moogie steps in and takes Buggin outside and gives him a talking to. It's like, you're fucking my shit up. You're coming to my place of work and being a dick. But what the camera does, it's all played out in one shot, and it follows Buggin out like and Moogie as they walk outside, slowly zooms in, and when it gets to the point where we're no longer framed inside the doorway and that disappears, the audio kind of shifts to outside, so that they had somehow rigged up some sound equipment outside, whether it was lav mics hidden on the actors themselves, or there was someone like hiding under frame with an additional boom or something.
Yeah, and it must have been two channels.
Yeah, and we get through the channel of the outside, and then when Moogie finally comes back in, we pull back out and we're back switched to inside audio. It's fucking beautifully made.
Wonderful. It's amazing. It's amazing. I felt like that's all true. I felt like the second half of the film was amazing, but then the first half seemed to drag slightly. There's only a single criticism that I have of the film, and it's just like your tolerance for what the film is doing, because it...
Do you think that's due to becoming acclimatized to it?
Well, you're being introduced to a myriad of characters, which takes a while anyway.
There's like 20, 30 characters you're introduced to, and it's in just fleeting moments.
I felt like I didn't know where the film was going for an amount of time that was maybe so long that it became sometimes uncomfortable.
Yeah. Do you think it would have helped if you knew going in that this is just a film where you were treated to a day in the life of, versus, like, did you have any idea of what it was going in?
I had no idea. I was expecting what's the Ice Cube?
Boys in the Hood.
Boys in the Hood. I was expecting a Boys in the Hood thing.
Yeah, which is still a great movie, but is totally different to this.
Like, I'll just say that I didn't expect the cop to kill Radio Raheem. I thought it was going to be one of the Italian guys offing one of the black guys.
Yeah.
So that was a good subversion of, I guess, it was a good surprise. But getting back to what I was saying, I suppose it's completely subjective, and you can take how much tolerance you can from just seeing how far is this going to, where is this story going to go? Eventually it's got to hit that point where you go, okay, now it's building up to a crescendo, which I'm fucking excited for. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And it's also one of those things where you don't expect this. Like, I hadn't seen it for a few years. I forgot how fucking funny the first half is as well, actually. Like, there's a lot of really light, funny, comedic moments, and then it slowly does the tonal shift as you get to know everyone as well. True. And it's
I'm not really aware of it until you said that, and then it's really rather seamless.
Yeah, and it's because when it's a kind of more light and comedic, you're sort of like wondering what this film is doing, because you have these light, funny moments that is every now and again like interjected with some racial hate, and you're like, that's jarring and awkward, but then it slowly transitions from kind of a lighter, more... I wouldn't even go so far as to call it a comedy, but it's really funny. Like, there's some really funny moments in there. Yeah. And it slowly moves into very serious drama.
And then when it gets to that point, you realise what the film is doing.
Yes.
And then I felt at that point, I'm there for the ride and I want to see it to its fruition.
Yeah, it's really wonderful what he does, like, by doing that, I think, as well. He gets you on side with every character. Like, you kind of sympathize, or you relate
There's an empathy.
Every single person in this film. The blacks, the whites, the Koreans that are in the milk bar across the road. Like, everyone is kind of equally represented in this film, and you...
Except for maybe the police officers. Because the only drag they have is literally the heat.
No, there's the one scene where you get the Italian douchebag who comes through and is fucking spray... when they're playing with the hydrant, trying to escape the heat, and he's like, don't you fucking spray my car, and then Martin Lawrence comes in and fucking sprays his car.
Yeah.
And he goes nuts at the cops, and the cop's like, shut the fuck up, dickhead. Yeah. Like, just leave him alone.
Let me just do my job.
Just leave him alone. We're not going to arrest them, and, you know, granted, he does do the little bit of a dick thing where he's like, don't fucking turn the hydrant back on. Which, like, he's doing his job, but he's doing it, in a way that, like, the one cop, I should say, the one that doesn't end up killing Radio Raheem, his partner, is like, just fuck off, leave him alone, it's hot. Like, yeah. So even they, who are the bad guys of the film, get one moment where it's like, they're not all that bad. They're just doing...
Yeah,
what they have to do.
I think if you look at it this way, like if the day was a cool day,
yeah,
everyone would be chill and nice, yes, and accommodating and prepared to help everybody out.
Yes,
it's just that it's a hot day and tempers flare just because people are a bit uncomfortable.
Exactly.
So you can get behind every character and go, they're normally not like this. I can imagine that there'll be good people if it's a normal fucking day.
The prime example of that, I think, is Bugging Out. Like, whose main thing is he wants a picture of a black... Why are there no brothers on the wall? Like, he just wants a photo of a black guy. You're in a black neighborhood. We're your clientele. We pay your fucking living. Why are we represented?
Yeah.
And, which is like, you can see where he's coming from. You can also totally see where Sal's coming from, because he's like, his response is, you open your own pizza place, you can put whoever the fuck you want on the wall.
Yeah.
But the reason why Bugging Out starts that whole fucking argument that ends up being the chain reaction that leads to the riot and Radio Raheem dying is because it's an extra dollar for cheese.
Yeah.
He got pissed off because it's hot. He wanted extra slice. He wanted extra cheese. It's a dollar for extra cheese. So he takes the free Parmesan that's on the counter and starts adding extra cheese, and Sal's like, nah.
Sal's being very fair.
And it's because Bugging Out's hot and pissed off and annoyed that he can't get extra cheese for free, he decides to pick a fight with Sal, and it's just this snowball effect. It's really fucking beautiful writing. Mm. It's like this one incident.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that there are no black people on the wall has nothing to do with anything. Like, it's just
an excuse to just rage for a moment.
Exactly. He's right. Pissed off, and that's how he's gonna rage.
Yeah.
It's wonderful writing, and it's just like that little seed that just grows into this fucking...
It is pretty crazy thing, man. Like, that's very subtle.
Yeah.
To have these incremental things. I suppose that's why it needs to be 2 hours long.
Yeah.
Because you need to experience, like, it's a slow process.
Yeah, exactly.
To get to a riot.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, should we just jump straight into that, the actual riot itself, and, like, where we end up?
Well, the riot, which it was something that I didn't fully understand, was that...
Before we get into that, actually, we'll put a pin in that for a sec. I quickly want to talk about probably the most famous shots of this entire film, which are the direct into camera, every single race...
Just being flagrant
and
racist.
Venting the extreme versions of their prejudice. Yeah. And everyone is represented, kind of belittling another side of race or culture within this microcosm.
Mm.
And it just kind of... That's the point where... That's about three-quarters of the way through the film. And it's the point where you kind of... The film really switches gears and kind of lets the audience know, like, this is where we're going. Like, this is... You can see...
It's intense, man. It's difficult to watch.
We've had the racial shit underneath, especially represented through John Turturro's character.
By the way, speaking of him, we should mention that awesome scene where it's Sal and John Turturro's character talking over in the window when I think Smiley comes up with the...
Oh, yeah,
and there's that bash heads of the two major points of difference.
Yeah.
The hate-fueled... anger of John Turturro versus Sal, the measured,
who's just like,
man.
I fed these kids. This is my neighborhood. This is
There's
my
no
place.
Difference here. There's no difference and distinction to make. Anyway, sorry, you were saying.
No, I think it's very effective the way that we've had the racial shit kind of bubbling under the surface, like, through kind of the kind of nice kind of mediated discussions between Sal and Pino and things like that. But it's only at this point where it finally fucking erupts. And it's really effective that it's in a surrealist way that is not actually happening in the reality of the film, but it is a sort of bizarre...
It's like a vision of...
It's like
everybody's
inside,
underneath
hatred. Exactly.
It's just like a depiction of hatred at its core.
Yeah, and he's absolutely brilliant the way that he presents it to be like, this isn't the film. This isn't what is act. This isn't happening. This is a representation of inner
an
feelings.
An element
yeah.
of everybody's
struggle. And the way that we snap back into it is seeing your love daddy, fucking Samuel L. Jackson, rolling in with his smooth voice, screaming, "Everyone chill the fuck out."
Yeah.
And then we're snapped back into reality. It's just beautiful filmmaking. But, yeah, we'll jump back to the riot itself. I just wanted to give some praise to that, because I think it is the important aspect of the film where it really kicks in.
Sure.
But, yeah, back to the riot. You were kind of saying how the riot initiates.
Yeah, so the riot is initiated by Mookie throwing...
Well, there's the fight that happens when Radio Raheem and Bugging Out come in, and they're like, "Brothers on the wall. But we're boycotting Sal's," he won't turn down his radio, and Sal finally fucking cracks it and breaks Radio Raheem's radio. They get into a fight, the cops show up, the cops unfortunately all gang up on the black guy, rip him off, and end up killing him.
The biggest one.
Yeah, and they kill him. Yeah. And it's interesting that they kind of throw him in the back of the car and drive away before anyone really knows what has happened.
It's accidental, but it's still
fucking murder.
It's still highly abusive.
But then, yes, you were saying it happens when Mookie throws a trash can through the window.
Yeah, I wasn't entirely clear why Mookie would go. I mean, Sal's thinking, "All right, fucking nobody touch my goddamn restaurant, please," and then it's Mookie, the supposedly a friend of Sal's.
Who in the literally in the scene right before this, before Radio Raheem and Bugging Out come into the pizza shop, he says, "Mookie, you're like a son to me. You will always have a place here at Sal's Pizzeria. You will always have a job. You are my third son."
Yeah.
And then this happens.
And he decides to take the bin.
Yes.
And effectively start the burn down of Sal's restaurant.
Yeah.
Why? Why would he do such a... Is that because it's insurance? He knows that it's insured?
It's a very interesting and clever thing that Spike Lee has done with this. He has made the climax of his film work in such a way that it can facilitate both ends of the argument. Whether it be the kind of righteous thing that he's doing, in that the mob is starting to turn against Sal and the kids.
Okay.
And to kind of... So you move the violence away from the people, direct it towards material thing, and not have another human being die.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be viewed in the way that another young black man has died for what? And fucking he's angry. And so he's on side with the black people. So it works in a way that
works. That's the second one I don't know about.
It's a little bit... It kind of goes against the character itself. But at that same time, Mookie has... periodically being like, "Fuck Sal, fuck this," like, you know, and his friend has just been murdered, so he's angry and he wants to take it out, and he's siding with the mob. So it's kind of nice that he's done it in a way that leaves it totally ambiguous.
Okay.
That however you as an individual interpret why Mookie did that is how and why he did it. Which I find really, an interesting thing I found was continually in press conferences, Spike Lee would get asked the question, "Did Mookie do the right thing by throwing the trash can?" Yeah. And apparently the only people that ask him that question are white people, which I thought is kind of interesting.
Did he do the right thing?
Yeah.
So why would black people not ask that question?
Because they just, I guess, assume like, yeah, of course he did.
They don't worry about it.
Yeah. And it's Spike Lee's kind of stock answer to that is, what, by asking that question, you have now just... put in, like, I don't have the actual quote, I'm just kind of trying to paraphrase it. By asking that question, if Mookie did the right thing, you are now questioning if material goods and property damage is equal to the death of a human being.
Yeah.
So, that's...
It's a shame.
Yeah, pretty much. Shame. So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
It's because he knew it was insured. That's because he makes that clear the next day.
Yep.
So he doesn't care. He knows that it doesn't matter if it gets destroyed because it's going to be rebuilt for next to nothing.
I think my interpretation is a little bit of both. Like, he's very fucking angry about what has happened.
Naturally.
And I think it's also him being a smart enough individual that he is redirecting the anger into... It's that thing of, like, we don't need more people to die. Like, that's not going to solve anything.
Mm.
Whereas everyone needs an outlet... That's this is it.
Let's break stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like, though, that the mob then, there's that one racist guy, the one of the three older guys who's sitting under the umbrella, who's just like, "You're next, you Korean motherfucker," just because he's racist towards the Koreans. He just immediately like, "It's your turn," and the mob's just like, "What the fuck? No, leave him alone."
Well, they were kind of ready almost.
Yeah, until the Korean spoke freaks. Up. Yeah, and he's just like, "I'm like you, I'm, you know.
I thought that was very sweet. That he was like, "I am you.
Yeah, and
we're brothers. Don't you fucking worry about
it." I like the Korean grocery store guy. Like, I love the scene where, where Raya Rahim comes in and he wants C like he wants the battery. He's like, "No, D motherfucker," and the guy's like, "No, motherfuck you." And Raya Rahim's like, "All right, well done." And he's like, it shows that, like, yeah, they as well are suffering prejudice from both sides, and it's so he's like, "All right, fine, yeah, fuck me."
Well, they're a part of that racial outburst.
Yeah, it's
that you were
really
talking about earlier.
Yeah, so good. I fucking love this film. I really do.
Is that why you bought it?
Yes, it is.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm a fan. I don't know, is there anything else you kind of want to address?
Let me check my Yoshi story book notes. we've covered all my notes.
I guess one last thing I'll jump into before we kind of start wrapping it up is I kind of want to address the controversy around this film.
Oh, of course.
When it first came out, it premiered at the 1989 Cannes Film Festival, where apparently a lot of the press kind of reported that they got very afraid of the film, in particular thinking that it would incite race riots.
It would if people didn't get it.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it would if people didn't get it.
Yeah, which I really like.
It's very clear on its message at the end with those with the text.
Yes, oh, very clear.
I mean,
which
if
is
you don't get it, you can just read the text at the
end. Yeah, which I think Spike Lee addressed really well in press conferences by saying, to make the assumption that black people would riot because they don't know the difference between fiction and non-fiction is fucking
it's
racist.
It's like the video game argument.
Yeah, that's it. It's absolutely stupid. So the actual essay that comes along with the Criterion edition is written by Roger Ebert, who was actually one of the film's biggest champions when it came out. Mm-hmm. Voted it not only the best film of the year, but he's in his top 10 films of all time.
Oh, yeah.
He writes about seeing it at the Cannes premiere and just kind of trying to avoid everyone else's ridiculous opinions about it and saying that, like, "Oh, it's dangerous. It's, oh my God, it's so controversial." He's like, "No, you just don't fucking get it." So, but yeah, there was
I don't really understand that. I don't understand how
I don't understand any controversy around any film. It's stupid people judging, like,
maybe it's just,
the idea that Clockwork Orange was banned in our country until 2002 is fucking retarded, or 2001 or whenever it was, is ridiculous. You watch that film now and you're like, this is a satire. Like, what do you don't fucking get it. Like, it's
satires. Yeah. Everybody gets satires.
But yeah, I just thought that was interesting that
this is not even a satire though. This is just like
no
commentary straight up. Very easy to understand.
Yeah, but and it just boggles my mind that people thought that this would incite a film itself that shows violence, in particular riots and race related violence. The kind of pointlessness of that exercise, to then think that would incite it is so feeble-minded, I think, and just crazy.
It might be just clickbaity.
Yeah.
Although they didn't have
they didn't have clickbait. Yeah, but yeah. I guess, but yeah. Food for thought, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
Controversial films are controversial films.
Yeah. But I guess if you got nothing else, move on to trivia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the film was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. Best Supporting Actor for Danny Aiello, who played Sal, and Best Original Screenplay. It was also nominated for 4 Golden Globes, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Screenplay, as well as the Palme d'Or at the 1989 Cannes Film Festival, and it was inducted into the National Film Library in the Vault of Congress in 1999.
Yes, a very important American film.
Yes. I do think it is really funny, though, that, I mean, watching it now, like we've said before in this episode, that the film is as relevant now as it was back then, unfortunately. It's a very powerful film that has very true and interesting themes and messages. was not nominated for Best Picture, and the film that ended up winning Best Picture that year was Driving Miss Daisy, a film that deals with race in a 180-degree different fucking opinion and is crazy.
I haven't seen that film.
Driving Miss Daisy is a story where Morgan Freeman plays the limo driver of a racist old lady in the South, and goddamn if they don't learn to become friends by the end of it.
Oh, okay. It's a sweet story, isn't it?
Or is saccharinely sweet.
Is he still, like, oppressed or something?
Oh, he's still just like, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm your friends. Okay. It's real fucking, like... It's like eating a candy bar sweet. Like, it's... There's no challenge to the themes at all with it, and it just kind of... It's just like, yeah, we can all be friends! Versus this that actually has rich media ideas. Yeah. It's like, no, let's actually have a dialogue about race in our country.
It's better to have a talk about race relations when people are angry.
Yes.
Because people do get angry, as opposed to everyone can be friends when everyone feels good.
Yeah.
So, fuck.
Yeah, pretty much. But I just thought that was interesting that, like, this film was not even nominated, yet... The film that won was like, yeah, we can all get along. It's similar to that whole Crash Brokeback Mountain thing. It's like, no, we can't give the film that's actually relevant and has an opinion the Oscar. We have to go to the one that's like, we all get along, it's fine. Fuck you, Academy Awards. You're so stupid. But yeah, moving on. The film was inspired by an actual incident in New York where some black youths were chased out of a pizzeria by some white youths in a section of New York known as Howard Beach. And, so Spike Lee, inspired by that kind of real-life event, wrote the screenplay for this in only 2 weeks.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Surely he had drafts.
Yeah, I've actually got a published book that's really fucking wonderful. It's, he hand-wrote it. And so I've got a book that is the scanned, handwritten pages of his screenplay. Fucking pretty wonderful.
Wow, that's, so he probably didn't have drafts then.
No, I think... I was reading as well, like, this...
Surely you have to have drafts. Like, how the fuck do you make a film like this?
I'm pretty sure it was this one that I read something online that said that the version of the film that is shown on screen is the initial film. Like, that's what he wrote.
Okay.
So,
I guess if that's the case.
I suppose if you're that fucking steadfast and firm in what you want to say, like, good on him.
Yeah.
Spike Lee originally wanted Robert De Niro for the role of Sal... but De Niro turned the part down, saying that it was too similar to many of the parts he'd played in the past.
But he said that he'd like to go on the wall anyway.
Well, that I think that's the nice little nod. There is the photo of him up on the wall to kind of give the nice little nod and a reference to him.
Yeah.
The opening dance sequence with Rosie Perez during the opening credits is inspired by Anne Margaret from Bye Bye Birdie. That was
a fabulous opening.
Yeah. That, I think, might have... jarred you a little bit as well, like, in kind of getting your bearings on the
film. It doesn't set the tone.
Not at all. It opens with... Granted, it's all played out to fight the power by Public Enemy, which we hear constantly. Yeah. But it
doesn't make sense in...
No, it's a happy dance number. It's... You're kind of like, what are we doing?
What kind of film is this?
Yeah.
You don't really know for the first
and
5 minutes.
And all the titles as well, they're in bright, colourful kind of writing. It's, yeah.
That's why I thought it was... That's why I was like gearing up for a Boys in the Hood kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Something a little bit, you know, mainstream and lighter, I guess. Yeah.
Something with Eddie Murphy in it.
Yeah. On both an interview and audio commentary for the Criterion DVD, Spike Lee says that the project was originally at Paramount, but the studio was worried about the climax and wanted it toned down. Lee refused to change the ending, and in the same weekend, Paramount turned the picture down, and Universal picked it up for distribution and immediately put it out, and it became what it became. Because he didn't want to compromise.
Good.
Can you imagine if that final scene, they, like, it's so weird to say, because I'm assuming, I think rightfully so, that all the executives at Paramount were rich old white guys. It was like, no, we can't have...
Yeah.
Tone down the actual message of your film.
It's 1989. So, no, but it probably wouldn't even be, like, now.
Yeah.
As well, so...
yeah, and apparently there was, in the original draft, like, originally there was the final scene of the film where it's Sal and Mookie the morning after the ride kind of having their conversation, their back and forth. Apparently there was it was more clear that they made amends and didn't leave it at the point where Mookie's just like, I owe you $50 and fucking walks away. Like, it's not... kind of left up in the air like that. They apparently buried the hatchet, but Spike Lee was like, No,
it's like a to be continued kind of
thing. Yeah, pretty much. Like, we don't need a happy ending here.
Yeah.
Like, especially what we've just put our audience through.
Yeah.
It would seem fake.
I like the idea that you're going to go away from it lacking something.
Yes,
so
and it makes you question. And
you've
got
to think about it a little bit while the credits roll.
Yeah.
As opposed to having it wrapped up in a nice little package.
Yeah, because then you're like, all right, cool, that was
cool.
Fun.
I can forget about this now and
go
about my business.
But like leaving it as just like, shit went down. You're like, yeah, it did.
And I need closure. I'm going to have closure by thinking and discussing the themes.
Yeah, exactly. Having rewatched this, I do think this is a fucking amazing piece of filmmaking.
Hmm, I would agree with you.
Yeah. But we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print and available as a two-disc DVD set through Criterion that comes with the special features of an audio commentary by Spike Lee, Ernest Dickinson, the cinematographer, production designer Wynne Thomas, and actor Joey Lee, who is Spike Lee's sister in real life and played his sister in the movie.
You don't say.
Yeah. New video introductions by Spike Lee, St. Clair Bourne's 60-minute documentary, The Making of Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee and line producer John Killick revisit the film's Bed-Stuy locations, Public Enemy's video for Fight the Power, also directed by Spike Lee, the 1989 Cannes Film Festival press conference with Spike Lee, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, Richard Edson, and Joey Lee, Spike Lee's behind-the-scenes footage from rehearsal to wrap, original storyboards for the riot sequence, new video interview with editor Barry Brown, as well as trailers and TV spots, and as I mentioned earlier, the wonderful essay written by Roger Ebert.
It's fucking heaps.
Yeah, very loaded edition. One thing we didn't actually talk about just reading that was Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, who are a brilliant heart of the film, I think, as Demare and Mother Sister.
Oh, right.
Two kind of patriarchs of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
They're fucking wonderful, and I think it's so perfect at the end in the riot scene that they are just like, come on, and they're trying to defuse, or the mayor in particular is trying to defuse the situation, and then it ends with Mother Sister just fucking weeping and him taking
consoling
her away.
Yeah.
Because it's a wonderful little note without saying it explicitly, but it's like they've been through this before. Like,
yeah, you do get the sense.
Like, this is, nothing has changed for them, it's seeming like. So it's just,
and for them to,
that's, I think, why
for them to rise above it is,
yeah,
the greatest achievement out of all of the characters, potentially.
Yeah. And that's why I think we have that shot of Mother Sister just weeping, because she's like, nothing has fucking changed.
Yeah, it's not going to stop, seemingly.
Yeah, yeah.
Or will it?
Fingers crossed!
Maybe.
It's 2015,
it hasn't
not
happened
much
yet.
Maybe by the time we're their age, we'll be like, alright, cool.
Probably not.
But I guess that'll probably wrap us up looking at this week's episode of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. If you have any comments or queries or anything of that nature, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter at @CriterionQuest.
Or if you know any black producers in Universal.
Yeah, if there were any, back in the 80s, any black people that were heads of the studios that were like...
Or today, I hope that we've progressed.
We've progressed to that extent. Hopefully. But yeah, we will be back next week when we actually get our first Michelangelo Antonioni film in the collection, when we look at La Ventura.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
I don't know who that guy is.
He's one of the classic kind of 60s Italian filmmakers.
Cool.
Yeah,
I like Italian films.
But we will be back next week. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time. You may have to edit that. Pause.
I'll let that ride. What we got to say.